And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Russell Moore is a familiar name in theological circles, but in his 8 years as the president of the policy arm of the powerful Southern Baptist Convention, he became more widely known for his withering criticism of Donald Trump, a position that put him at odds with many in the conservative evangelical movement that became Trump's strongest base. Now public theologian at Christianity Today and a Pritzker Fellow at the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics, Moore sat down with me this week to discuss his journey and the sometimes uncomfortable intersection between faith and politics. Here's that conversation. Russell Moore, so good to be with you and so good to have you at the Institute of Politics. You've been an incredible presence around here and I influenced a lot of young people and so happy to have you.
Well, thank you. It's been a joy to be here and I'm really impressed with the students here at the Institute of Politics.
Yeah, well, I'm eager to talk about them as part of this conversation later on because I'm eager to hear what kind of dialogue you've had. Clearly, you've been challenged by them, and I'm eager to hear how you deal with that in an era in which tolerance and grace are not lead qualities in our public discourse. So regrettably,
right.
But
yeah.
I want to first explore your own story, and which begins primarily in Biloxi.
Yes, I grew up in Biloxi, Mississippi, and all of my family was there. And which is, Biloxi is, when people think Mississippi, they think of Tupelo. This is more New Orleans. It's right over the state line from New Orleans. So heavily immigrant population, mostly Catholic, Mardi Gras sort of a place.
Immigrant from Latin America?
Or? No, immigrant from Serbia and Czech Republic area.
Interesting.
And then also Vietnamese immigrants after the fall of Vietnam, massive numbers of Vietnamese refugees.
And what was the dynamic in the community relative to immigration and immigrants? Were there tensions in the community, or were immigrants well accepted in the community?
I think largely well accepted. I do remember a great deal of fear in the community when the Vietnamese population first arrived. I remember being a kid and hearing people say, on the one hand, these people are coming in to take our welfare dollars. They're going to be dependent on the state. And these people are taking all of our jobs in the seafood industry. And knowing both of those things can't be true at once, and one or the other. And of course, neither ended up being true. And they're a vital part of the community now.
We have echoes, of course, of that debate in our politics today.
Yes.
We'll talk about that. But your family was always deeply, faith was deeply ingrained in your family life. Your grandfather was a pastor, is that right?
My grandfather was a pastor of the church I grew up in. My dad, not as much. My dad had more of a conflicted relationship to the church because he grew up a pastor's kid. So he had seen the sort of behind-the-veil dynamics, which are really similar to life in a political leader's home.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had he saw it as a, when I told him that I was planning to go into ministry, it was almost as though I was telling him that I had been arrested because he said, I'm going to support you whatever you do, but I don't want you to get hurt.
You know, I've done so many of these now and often talking to people in politics and some whose fathers were in politics, mostly fathers. And that approach aversion thing is very strong.
Yes.
Among them. So it's interesting. It's interesting that you put it in those terms. Speaking of, and your dad was, I should point out, he was an FBI agent. And then he came back to Biloxi and went into sales.
Yes, he was working in the car business. And he just died this past year. So in the year of pandemic and loss, yes, it's been on my mind quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, I'm so sorry for your loss. You had your own experience at when you were 12 that sort of ushered in your passion, your deep belief. Tell me about that.
The religion became my own when I was about 12, where I was convinced of the truth of the gospel. And I also was feeling a pull toward ministry shortly thereafter. But when I was 15, I went into a major time of spiritual crisis, and quite a bit of it actually had to do with politics. Because I was looking around at, not in my congregation particularly, but just in the broader Bible Belt, racism. I was looking at the sort of scandal that we now have seen quite a bit, unfortunately. And I was looking at the use of politics, where I could see these voter guides, for instance, that would end up in churches that would have the Christian view and the non-Christian view, and they just happened to line up with all of the issues that that whoever the church was supporting as a candidate had. And so it seemed like a really cynical use of the faith to argue that there's a Christian view of the balanced budget amendment or mm-hmm. the line item veto. And so that caused me to wonder, well, what if this ultimately is just politics, which means it's just a means to an end? And that was a deeply distressing thought to me. Now, thankfully, I'd read the Chronicles of Narnia so many times as a child that I recognized the name of C.S. Lewis on the spine of Mere Christianity, and I brought it home from the bookstore. It was transformative to me, not so much in terms of the arguments, because my problem wasn't intellectual. My problem was, am I being sold something? And so you could just tell from the, for lack of a better word, tone of voice coming through that book, that this was someone who wasn't selling me anything. He was pointing to something deep and rich and ancient. And that helped turn my life
around. You know, what is it that drew you in? What is it? What was the truth that drew you in and made you such a deep believer?
Well, the figure of Jesus, and reading the Gospels and recognizing this person was transformative for someone who grew up singing, "Yes, Jesus loves me," and all the things that you do in Southern Baptist Sunday school, to actually come to believe this is a person who loves me, and this person is alive and is worth following. That's what was transformative. And to see that some of the things at present in my home church were culturally bound, I could see that very early. But at the heart of it, it was connected to something ancient and historic that goes all the way back to the first century.
You know, you mentioned the politicization of the church. That was just about that period when the Christian Coalition was coming into prominence.
Right.
Pat Robertson was deeply involved in that. Ultimately, Ralph Reed became sort of a political operative turned organizer of the Christian Coalition. Put that in historical context for where we are today. How has that, what is the thread of continuity between what we see today, and what do you think that has done to the church, the Southern Baptist Convention, to evangelical movements in general?
Well, the first president I remember, I was 5 years old when Jimmy Carter was elected.
Yeah.
And at that time, there was no predicting on the basis of where someone went to church or didn't go to church, whether that person had voted for Carter or Ford. As a matter of fact, most people that I knew were elated that Jimmy Carter was elected because he was one of us. He was a first president from the Deep South since the Civil War, and he was a born-again Christian. So that didn't narrowly sort people out into categories. That, of course, changed quite a bit as we moved into the 1980s and then beyond. Some of that, I think, because of changes in the Republican Party, but some of it because of changes in the Democratic Party as well. So there were people who came to conclude the Democratic Party doesn't want us, and so let's ask who does. At the same time that you had people who understood that religion is a powerful organizing tool, which is exactly what I was worried about as a 15-year-old. I do think that there are social and political implications to what the Bible teaches. That forms us into people with consciences that ought to pay attention to specific matters, but it doesn't come with a voter registration card. And that's what has changed quite a bit. If you look at the racial differences between white evangelicals and black evangelicals, for instance, it could not be more of a contrast than that, which tells me that something's going on culturally and sociologically much long before it's happening theologically and congregationally.
I think about the civil rights movement, which mm-hmm. very much emanated from the black church, Dr. King and others. How would you characterize that compared to what you saw evolving in the 80s?
Well, I had a student here at the IOP who asked, when I was talking about grievance-based politics that we see now, who said, well, wasn't the civil rights movement grievance-based politics? Didn't Dr. King have grievances? And yes, of course, there were specific problems to which he was pointing, the bigger system of Jim Crow, but then also the Montgomery bus system and so forth, specific instances. But ultimately, it was about changing these structures and about persuading the people on the other side. I mean, when King was speaking, he's speaking with the kind of moral imagination that assumes that the people who disagree with him right now can be persuaded. And if not, that their children and their grandchildren could be persuaded. That's just an entirely different mode of activism than what we often see now, which is actually not speaking to the other side. It's speaking for applause from one's own side. And that keeps even the imaginative appeal of persuasion from happening.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of politics, you took a detour.
Yes.
From your at least your career path into politics.
Yes.
And you worked for a congressman, Gene Taylor from Mississippi, who was a Democrat.
Yes.
Ultimately was defeated in 2010. But tell me about that decision. I know you studied political science and so on in college. Was it your notion that you were going to take that path?
Yes, that was at the time I thought I was going to take that path. And those years with Gene were formative in ways I can't even describe, because I noticed working for him that when I would talk to other people, when I started out as an intern on Capitol Hill in the summer, talk to other people who had reason to be ashamed of their members of Congress and would talk about, can't believe what this member of Congress I'm working for is doing. I was seeing somebody who actually was the same person on the House floor as he was driving around the district campaigning. And I also saw someone for whom integrity really mattered. I mean, this was somebody who was out of step really at every point. He was a Democrat in a majority Republican district, had a lot of pressure to switch parties, and he said, I won't do it. And he was a very conservative Democrat, pro-life, fiscally conservative, very, very pro-military, and he had a lot of pressure from his own caucus to change, and he wouldn't do it. So I would go with him sometimes at what I kind of would call heresy trials, where he would be with the base criticizing him for not. I remember one time being with him with a Democratic County Committee that was, they were really upset that he had said in 1992, this was, that if the presidential election went to the House of Representatives, which at the time was a possibility, Ross Perot was in the race at the time, that if it went to the House of Representatives, he would vote for whoever received a plurality in the 5th Congressional District of Mississippi. They wanted an assurance that he would vote for Clinton.
Bill Clinton,
yes. Well, I knew Gene didn't even vote for Clinton himself in the general election and never did, to my knowledge, but he wouldn't do it. And so we left that meeting. It was very heated. I was driving him. And I was shaking. I was so nervous. And he just sat down in the car and said, all right, let's, and started talking about something else. And I said, are you not thrown by that? Who cares about that? You know, I'm here for my constituents, not for that. So I was able to see that sort of side of him in a way that in many ways reaffirmed my belief in the possibilities of politics. So I didn't leave that. I didn't leave Gene Taylor world cynical or disillusioned by politics at all. It wasn't that sort of, it was just that I remember going to the Library of Congress. They would have discard books that congressional staffers can take, and I would get all sorts of books. And one of them was a guide to doing weddings and funerals. And I remember not even thinking about it. And then when I was at home later that night thinking, why did I want this? And that sort of caused the process of rethinking the path of my life, but not because I concluded that something was ugly or wrong with politics. That would come later.
And you you decided to go down another road. You trained and you became a pastor. And you had sort of this, I would say, meteoric rise in the Southern Baptist Convention. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, it's something similar to what I said to a student this morning who was thinking through trying to plan his life. And I sensed that he was trying to avoid going in a wrong direction. And I said, look, you can't plan it out with that detail. Usually you look backward and you see how things that you thought were cul-de-sacs actually come together in what it is that you're called to do. And I think that's true for people in virtually every vocation. And that certainly was true for me. I would see all of these various influences that tended to come together. And I was utterly devoted to the Southern Baptist Convention because my experience was very different from that of my dad. I grew up in a congregation that was loving, was cohesive. I never really saw the dark side as I'm growing up. So when I thought about the church, and particularly when I thought about the Southern Baptist Convention, I thought about something that was, they were the people who had introduced me to Jesus, and I really believed in what we were doing together.
Ultimately, you became the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, which is the policymaking arm of the Southern Baptist Convention. Tell me how you thought about that job. I mean, there were obvious issues that are associated with the church, that, you know, relative to abortion and and gay rights and so on. We'll talk about that. But you emphasize things like immigration and particularly refugees. You had a history of leadership on those issues. How did you choose the issues that you wanted to emphasize? And what was the philosophy that you brought to that job? Were you trying to reorient?
I came into office, my predecessor, Richard Land, a very well-known figure in the religious right, had been through a great deal of controversy, largely over his comments after the shooting of Trayvon Martin. It was a very tense situation. I came into office really wanting to do two things. The first thing is to help Baptist Christians to think through the moral implications of our faith on the full range of issues. And then only after that, to speak to policies. So I was constantly working to sort of keep the order of priority in line, in my view. And when it came to, for instance, the issues of immigrants and refugees, that really wasn't a deviation. Because if you look at what the Southern Baptist Convention was adopting every year in their resolutions, very pro-refugee, pro-immigration, pro-immigration reform, going all the way back to the Bush administration and continuing since then. So what was also true is that one of the things that I learned in this role, I remember working on immigration reform, for instance, being in the Oval Office and being in Congress, it became very clear that what really mattered when it came to immigration is who cared about it the most. And who typically cared about it the most were the 20% or the 25% who opposed it. They were the ones for whom that's the only issue, and that's what they're devoted to. But there were people who, for whom any talk of immigration is George Soros, conspiracy theories. You know.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. It would be, I think, as it is in all aspects of analysis about Trump, it would be, I think, a mistake to say he created he created circumstances. He capitalized on them. He made turbocharged them. So, you know, I was interested. I was talking to you earlier about this splendid piece that a person you and I both know, you better than I, Pete Wehner, wrote in The Atlantic just recently, called The Evangelical Church is Breaking Apart. And he, he talks about all the influences that have basically torn people away from, you know, the catechesis of the church, mm-hmm. and replaced it with cultural prompts, TV, radio, social media, Facebook, and so on. How have those worked to undermine the vision that you had, that, you know, of moral teachings and so on?
Well, I think there are a couple of ways. I mean, if you look at the national level, one of the things that's really concerning to me is probably the exact opposite of what would be concerning to most people on the left. Most people on the left would probably be worried about the religious right becoming more and more theocratic and more religiously extreme. I actually think that's not what's happening. What's happening is a secularizing of Christian political action in some really troubling sorts of ways, because there's a piece in the Hedgehog Review out of the University of Virginia that I think is brilliant about the changing shape of the culture wars, which noticed the difference between even vocation of leadership. So you go from Jerry Falwell Sr., whatever you think of Jerry Falwell Sr., he was a preacher. That it was coming out of his role as a preacher, to Jerry Falwell Jr., who was a real estate developer. Pat Robertson, that you mentioned, was a broadcaster, but he was coming to broadcasting from primarily this role of being a Bible teacher, to talk radio hosts. I mean, that shift has been really dramatic just in terms of leadership. Then when you get to the congregational level, what you have is, I think there's a sense of, Walker Percy writes in The Moviegoer about Binks Bowling in New Orleans, who would go to the public library and would read National Review and The New Republic together. And he said he didn't know if he was a conservative or a liberal, but the hate that they had for each other made him feel alive. I think there's a very real sense where that is so present in American life, and that bleeds over into congregational life in a way where what the Bible would refer to as an unhealthy craving for controversy starts to dominate every aspect of life. And so I started seeing this happen.
Let me just interrupt you and say it's not accidental, because the business model of a lot of,
oh, absolutely,
you know, whether it's talk radio,
yes,
or social media and the tech platforms, or, you know, television and the way we've balkanized that, you know, those business models rely on getting people to click and to stay on,
yes,
and to watch. And
that's the
resentment and hate is a pretty powerful attraction.
Yeah, and that's the opposite model of when the primary issue is mission, So if what you see the rest of the world around you, if you see everyone as a potential future brother or sister in Christ, you really do have confidence in the power of the gospel, that changes the way that you see people. People aren't then able to be demonized because you actually believe in demons. And, you know, we're not wrestling against flesh and blood. So, but when that changes and when the incentive structure is toward the adrenal feeling of rage, that takes on an entirely different shape. So I saw this, I think, for the first time in maybe around 2009, 2010, when Glenn Beck had something called the Restoring Honor rally, yes, or something like that, on the National Mall in D.C. And what was disturbing to me is that I would see so many evangelical Christians that I knew on social media talking about how great it was that Glenn Beck is preaching the gospel. And I listened to that speech. He didn't preach the gospel at all. He was talking about political grievances and issues. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but that's not the gospel of Jesus Christ. And it was just easy to make that shift when there's so much pressure to be part of a cultural political tribe that gives identity. When that is constantly facing people, it becomes very difficult for those people to step back and say, I may be a Republican or a Democrat, but my priority is something else, which means I'm going to keep that at least to a large degree at a distance. That's very difficult to communicate.
Yeah, Wehner wrote, for many Christians, their politics has become more of an identity marker than their faith. They might insist that they're interpreting their politics through the prism of Scripture, with the former subordinate to the latter, but in fact, Scripture and biblical ethics are distorted to fit their politics. Yeah. And, you know, we've seen this not just in evangelical among evangelical Christians, but among faiths, other faiths,
yes,
as well, where faith then becomes a justification for political positions that are really not drawn from faith.
Yeah. You know, our friend Adam Kinzinger in the House tweeted the other day, I've known lots of people who have left their churches over politics. I've not met one person who has changed their politics because of their church.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sadly really resonant right now.
And it's dangerous if you believe that your political positions are somehow a product of the gospel. It changes your orientation about the urgency and the rectitude of your positions. It makes it harder to step back and have a reasoned discussion.
Well, and not only that, there's this sense of, when I first went to the ERLC, I told my wife, if you ever hear me say the words, this is the most important election in our lifetime, to just take the keys away, because I had heard that every 4 years. I never heard anyone say, you know, this election isn't it's important, but it's not ultimate. But they can't all be the most important election in our lifetimes. But there's this sense of total victory or total defeat that comes into people's minds, where we're either going to be exuberant in our winning or we're going to be totally defeated in our losing. And so the winning and the losing becomes an existential threat.
We've now taken it one step beyond, which is we're not going to accept losing.
Correct, yes.
We're not going to accept any loss as a legitimate reflection of public opinion, which in a democracy is a death knell.
Nuance is not an incentive structure. And so to be able to come in and say, this political leader I think is mostly wrong, but I can work with him or her on these sets of issues we agree on, becomes a threat to tribal identity in a way that's very, very difficult to undo. What's changed in the last few years, I was seeing these dynamics at the Washington level and at the political level, but now I'm seeing them all over the place at the congregational level, where what I'm hearing from every day are pastors who are beleaguered because They're trying to figure out what to do about masks, for instance, during the height of the COVID pandemic, and their congregations are at each other's throats over that. It's not the same thing as just, well, we're trying to decide what to do. It becomes a question of who's going to win and who's going to lose. Or a pastor I knew who simply prayed sometime around the inauguration for President Biden and Vice President Harris. This is not an unusual thing to do in an evangelical context. We're commanded, 1 Timothy 2, to pray for governing authorities, but he had someone stand up and start yelling, that's not the president. So even these, it's not just that you have pastors who are facing backlash because they're taking courageous stands on refugees. That's true, and that happens. But even the people who are not really interested in addressing these political issues at all are facing this. Or a pastor that I talked to recently, all he did was to pray for the family of George Floyd after the murder of George Floyd, and has dealt with a backlash of his being a critical race theorist ever since. I mean, that sort of thing has now, it has gone down to the congregational level and to the family dinner table in a way that has really flipped a lot of the concerns. When 10 years ago, I would have parents concerned about their children leaving home and secularizing and losing their faith. Now, what I'm hearing are children, adult children, who are saying, what do I do with my mom and dad who have become radicalized on Facebook? Or
And there is a generational split here.
There's definitely a generational split. And that's that was another thing I was able to say. Well, there is a generational shift happening in evangelicalism, which is true. The old dynamics don't apply to the younger generation, not because the younger generation is liberalizing. If anything, they're theologically more conservative than their parents and grandparents were, but because they're very suspicious of any cynical use of the faith.
You know, it does speak to the fact that even in the pastoral role, if you're trying to get people to come to the church, to fill the seats, to fill collection plates, to listen to you, there is a lot of pressure to appeal to what sells.
Right. Oh, that's exactly right. That's always been the case, and it's constantly the case. The difference is now that applies to absolutely everything. So a friend of mine and I were talking about the pressure that's on pastors right now to be not only biblical exegetes and theologians, political scientists and pollsters, public health experts and epidemiologists, all of these things, so that if they, one pastor said when the Biden administration sent down the vaccine mandate, he had people in the congregation saying, "Your silence is deafening." And he said, "I don't even know what this policy, I don't know OSHA policy. How can I be expected to be an expert in that?" That's what's happened in American life. And I wish I could say that congregations are exempt from it, but they're not.
I mentioned Trump earlier. When he ran for president, he was the object of suspicion at first among evangelical voters. Over time, they became his strongest supporters. And there is nothing from my observation that would necessarily recommend him as a human being.
Right.
Donald Trump, I think his deep faith is in Donald Trump.
Correct.
And not anything else. And you were very outspoken about him.
Yes.
From the beginning. Tell me what that experience was like as he was becoming the dominant political voice, and I'd argue more than a political voice, like a cultural leader, a white identity leader.
Yeah.
You were outspoken in your criticism.
Yes. I mean, this wasn't a figure that was unknown to us. This wasn't someone who was having to introduce himself to the American people. Any of us who were alive in the 1980s remember all of the Donald Trump news. And then I remember being really concerned as early as 2014, I think, when the Ebola issue was happening, and Donald Trump had criticized missionaries who were treating people with Ebola and were trying to get back into the country to get medical treatment, and said something along the lines of they knew what they were doing, they chose to do this, and they should pay the consequences, which I thought was a reprehensible comment. And then you add to it all of the other things. What I found was that when I first started talking about this, most people in the evangelical social conservative world agreed with me. They weren't as outspoken as I was, but they didn't disagree with me about any of it. As a matter of fact, when I did the op-ed in the fall of 2015 about evangelicals who are supporting Trump are betraying their own professed values, many of the people who later became key figures of support for Donald Trump were the people calling me to say, finally, someone is expressing what I think. Thank you for saying this. Then that started to shift, not because Donald Trump changed, but because he started winning. And so there was a figure who I was listening to a radio program one time where she said, she was talking about evangelicals and Donald Trump, and she said, you can just see Russell Moore going through the stages of grief throughout the 2015-2016 election, because first it was, well, evangelicals aren't supporting him, which was true. And then, well, church-going evangelicals aren't supporting him. These are nominal evangelicals, which was true at the time. Then, well, evangelicals are supporting him, but because they see it as a lesser of two evils calculation, which was largely true at the time, but then it didn't hold. And that was my big concern, because I had seen this pattern happen before, even with people who weren't trying to demagogue, where the tribal leader changes the base. And so the people who would say, one person, a good friend, said to me, I'm not voting for one person, I'm voting for 1,000 people. I'm voting for an administration, I'm voting for judges, I'm voting for these things. Okay, that's a reasonable case. It wasn't the case I made, it wasn't the conclusion I came to, but it's a reasonable conclusion. Problem is, very few people were then able to say, okay, I'm voting for this person, and then I plan to hold him accountable to say this is awful behavior or so forth. That didn't happen. Instead, it wasn't that.
So why, Russell? What made him? What allowed him to take such hold within the evangelical community? Was it the white identity politics? Was it his? His embrace. I mean, he had been a pro-choice person till shortly before the election, but then became an advocate for judges and who would overturn Roe versus Wade and so on. What is it that?
Well, I think to some, there are many evangelicals for whom for the same reasons as the general public, general Trump supporter and evangelical Trump supporter, they would have the same sort of calculation. And I think one sort of key defining moment was in the debate with Hillary Clinton, when she said on the stage, when asked about late term abortion, when she gave an answer that didn't even work through the moral implications at all, didn't even acknowledge, I can see why people would find this to be awful. That was a moment where I saw even many very reluctant Trump supporters turn into committed Trump supporters.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. You periodically, I think when Charlottesville happened, you were outspoken about that and so on. How much pressure did you come under within conference to just pipe down?
Constantly. I mean, I I was in and out of heresy trials, basically, for 5 years. So, I mean, maybe the most after Access Hollywood. When Access Hollywood happened,
the tape in which Trump was profanely discussing his exploits with women in a really disgraceful way.
Right. I assumed anyone listening to that tape would conclude that this is not a person who is fit to be in public office. Certainly people who have been warning us all for years about moral relativism and about sexual anarchy and these sorts of things. I assumed that they would see this and say, that's a step too far. When I spoke to that, I was immediately getting unbelievable pushback from people who are saying, how can you criticize someone who's on our side? And I would say, well, who's our here? I mean, this is that I didn't sign up to be on Donald Trump's side. I signed up to be on the side of Jesus Christ. And so you would have these sorts of constant pressures to meet with groups of people who were upset. We had some people who threatened to withhold money from the convention's missions program because I wouldn't support Trump. And these sorts of things. I remember at one point, this was actually after the defeat of Trump, and someone was in one of these meetings criticizing me and said, why don't you just commit now that you will not criticize our elected officials? And I said, okay, so let me just get this right. You are opposed to my criticizing President Biden last week about the attempt to repeal the Hyde Amendment. Oh, no, that was good. I said, so what you're saying is, what you're asking me to commit to is not that I won't criticize elected officials, is that I won't criticize this group of elected officials.
Yeah.
Well, that's not what I was. We have a phrase called surrendering to ministry in my tradition. When I walked down the aisle and committed my life to ministry, that's not what I was signing up for. I was signing up to follow Christ, which means to speak honestly to people and to say, here is how I see this. You can do with it what you want, but I mean, the shift from the Bill Clinton era to the Donald Trump era, it wasn't as though you had people saying, I really wrestled with this question of moral character, and I've come to conclude it actually doesn't matter. Almost no one said that. Instead, it was, well, yes, but think of how high the stakes are.
Did you see this as choosing between Christ and choosing between Trump?
For me, I saw it as choosing between my conscience under Christ and saying things that I didn't believe.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been easy to say, well, this is who most of our people, this is who they're with, and so I'm going to get on board. But to do that, I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have lived with myself, and I have five sons. I couldn't have communicated that to them. So there never was a moment. I never had a moment where I thought, maybe I'll get on board with Donald Trump. Now, what I did think was, after he was elected, well, let's give him a chance in the way we do any other president. Let's hope that he takes seriously this office, that he tries to unite the American people. And
How'd that work out?
Yeah, it didn't work out.
You talked about his abuse of women and his moral values. You resigned earlier this year from your position.
Yes.
And you wrote a letter that became public, and it was a scathing letter about the unwillingness to take on sexual abuse within the church, to take on racism within the church. The intimation, not more than the intimation, this was that you had tried to fight these battles and were rebuffed. Tell me about that.
Well, I'll tell you what is encouraging. The discouraging is there. The encouraging is, again, as I said before, most people at the congregational level actually want to in my perception, actually want to do the right thing. And I saw a shift from over the last decade. When I first started talking about issues of sexual abuse, there would be, you would usually have to persuade people that this actually is a problem. People would say, well, that's something that happens. The Catholic Church doesn't happen with us, or that may happen somewhere, but it wouldn't happen in our congregation because we know each other. That started happening less and less, and people started recognizing this is a serious problem and this could happen here. Didn't, though, happen with everyone.
Well, was the concern among the leadership that you who you confronted that they would lose churches, that pastors would disassociate themselves? What is it? Didn't want the taint on the church?
I don't know. I can't really speak to anyone else's motivations. I can only tell you my motivations were in coming across so many people who had been sexually abused and assaulted in a church context and seeing what had happened. To me, this is the most reprehensible thing that can possibly happen, not only because it's self-evidently an awful thing, but because it's an awful assault on someone that is allegedly in the name of Jesus in the safest place they could possibly be. And so to think about, you know, my own home church that really was a home for me and in which there was this circle of trust in those people. To think of that being used in any church context, it's awful in any context, but especially in a church context, I think is one of the most horrible things that can happen.
What about race?
Well,
because you've said this is something that struck you from the time you were a child.
Yes. Yes. I remember being really little in Sunday school and having a Sunday school teacher say, because we would bring these little envelopes that would have our offering in it, you know, a quarter in it for offering. And I had taken the quarter out and put it in my mouth. And she said, "Don't put that quarter in your mouth. A black man may have touched that." And I remember thinking at the time, this doesn't really line up with singing Jesus loves little children, all the children of the world. I mean, those two things can't really go together. So, yes, that's also, I think, a matter of integrity and credibility, because this is one of the very first things addressed by the newly formed Christian church is, how do you have together in one body people for whom there are great ethnic and religious, prior religious divisions between Jews and Gentiles? The gospel unites those people into one body and says that we're to bear one another's burdens, which means that when you have African-American Christian moms who are worried about their sons going out at night, that's my problem too. They're worried about what will happen if their sons get stopped by the police. That's now my problem too. Or when, as one African-American pastor said to me one time, he was going through college applications with his son, and he was praying that he wouldn't get into some schools because he thought they would be unsafe for him as a young black man. And to realize there are many things that I would be considering as I'm going through college applications, but I would never have to consider that.
So how does white identity politics overcome, how has it become such a dominant force? And was it exacerbated by the election of the guy I worked for, the first African-American president? What impact did that have?
I don't think it was created by that at all. Yeah, I think it goes back to Cain and Abel, because I think this is, I think there's something about racism that is at its root, and I mean this literally, satanic, in the prizing of one's own flesh and the demonization of another person created in the image of God. I think there's something deeply, deeply twisted about that, and that certainly goes back a very long time.
The whole thing, Russell, birtherism.
Yes. Yes.
And Trump was in the middle of that. Was that an inflammatory thing?
For me, not as much, because I would find the birtherism and that sort of thing much more often among people who were not church going for all sorts of reasons. I mean, the Cato Institute did a study that surprised a lot of people, didn't surprise me at all, that when you had the more evangelistic a church was trying to share the gospel with people, the less xenophobic that congregation would be, and the more likely they were to care for refugees and immigrants. That doesn't surprise me at all. So the sort of furthest fringes of the birtherism stuff, I found a lot more in nominal religion than I found with at least expressly within the church. Now, there was a lot of concern with the Obama administration, and a lot of that I shared on some religious freedom issues and so forth. But that sort of white identity grievance, I didn't see as much during the Obama administration as I would see later.
When Trump came along.
Yeah.
You know, Donald Trump is a guy who does not believe in rules or laws or norms or institutions. And he really believes that the world belongs to the strong. And that anything you do in your self-interest is right. And anything you don't do in your self-interest makes you weak. And that whole presentation, that whole sense seems to have been embraced by people at least around the evangelical movement, but just more broadly among his followers. I mean, what do you make of all of that?
Well, I became really alarmed when I heard an evangelical leader defending Trump say he's not one of these weak-kneed, turn-the-other-cheek guys. And I'm really thinking, how do you hear yourself saying that when turn-the-other-cheek is a direct quotation from Jesus Christ? And so I've seen this shift happen with some people. Jerry Falwell Jr., he and I had a tussle over migrant children. I simply said, hey, we can do better than separating moms from kids at the border. His response on social media was to say, you've never built a business and made payroll. And I'm thinking, how is that the qualification to speak to the moral treatment of people created in the image of God? But it's that's why I'm saying what concerns me is that it's not that these religious groups come into the political arena and shift it. It's that the political arena often shifts us.
I want to ask you about your friend Mike Pence, and I know you're close. I remember when Trump chose him. And the explanation that you heard in political circles was Trump needed to certify himself to the evangelical movement with whom Pence had a close relationship. Mm-hmm. He ended up being kicked to the curb at the end because he wouldn't decertify the election, as it were. What parable do you see in Pence's journey?
Well, I mean, it's hard to see someone who could be more loyal. And I think for entirely good reasons. I really don't think that Mike Pence is a sycophant. I think he saw the example of George H.W. Bush, of a vice president who knows he's vice president and isn't trying to be president, and who's loyal. And he was that. Both, I think you can talk to anybody who's ever been in a meeting with Mike Pence. No one's ever heard him say a negative or even just sort of an eye-rolling kind of, can you believe this guy? He never did that, publicly or privately, and he may be the only person in the administration.
Even when people were shouting, hang Mike Pence, and Trump did not intervene?
Right. Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying is the sad endpoint is what happened on January 6th, which when I saw that happening, I was filled with rage. And I had many people calling and saying, well, you're vindicated now on Trump. Everyone sees it. And I said, no, I've learned my lessons from Access Hollywood. What's going to happen is everyone's going to see the horror of this for a few days. And then people are going to find a way to push it out of the way and say it doesn't matter. And sadly, I think that's what happened.
Do you foresee a Trump resurgence? And if so, how concerned are you about that?
I don't think there's ever been a Trump desurgence. I mean, I think that there were many people who said, and I had someone in elected office say to me, yeah, you don't understand how Republicans work. When you lose an election, it's who's Richard Nixon? and they move on. And so once an election's over, then the party will move on. Well, that's not happening. And the people who are in elected office, who are alarmed about Trump, and there are a lot of them, but they don't speak publicly, most of them. And so I don't think he's had any change in terms of the support that he has. The question is there an alternative? And looking around the Republican Party right now, certainly is hard to see who could be an alternative for people's loyalty and votes. So I think it's entirely possible that he could run in 2024 and win.
You know, you talk about these religious freedom issues, and we're here at the Institute of Politics. When we announced that you were going to come, we got a really concerned and thoughtful note from a young man who is gay, mm-hmm. and he sent some of your writings, mm-hmm. casting homosexuality as sin, and he was deeply offended by that. There are plenty of students here who are pro-choice and mm-hmm. believe that a woman should be able to make those decisions. How do you have a dialogue with, what do you say to those students when they confront you about your own deeply held views? And how do we have a dialogue in this society about these issues?
Yeah, well, I could tell you, I've been in heresy trials that I'm too friendly toward LGBT people in my context. And what I would often say in those settings is, look, if you're going to deal with Roman Catholics who hold to Roman Catholic teaching and evangelical Christians who hold to evangelical Christian teaching and Orthodox Jews and Muslims who hold to the traditional tenets of those faiths, you can't say in order for us to speak to one another, you have to give all of that up and become a Unitarian. I mean, that's not the way that we are going to be able to speak to one another. Instead, I think we have to be in a situation where we're honestly in dialogue, and there are going to be times where you're not going to change 2,000 years of Christian teaching, in my mind, but there are all sorts of other areas where, for instance, I never gave much thought to reparative therapy, really, until I started hearing from people who had been really harmed by that idea that they could go through therapy and prayer and completely change their sexual orientation. I mean, we can learn from one another and in those sorts of areas, but I don't think we can demand that we give up all of our viewpoints before we have those dialogues.
What about in the public square? Because part of your job was to promote the priorities of the conference. What about the idea that we shouldn't enforce our private beliefs or our religious beliefs in the public square, where there are clearly differences?
Yes, and no, I don't think that we should impose any church's religious teaching or any religion's religious teachings. There's an old Baptist preacher who used to say, everybody wants theocracy and everybody wants to be Theo. And I think that's largely true, and it's a warning. But I do think that we're going to come into the public square shaped and formed by the things that matter the most to us. So for people who are religious, that's often going to be religious teachings. That doesn't say that you have to agree with me and that you have to conform, but it says I'm telling you why I care about this particular set of issues. And so with the major concern when it comes to some of these culture war issues for most church-going evangelical Christians is not that they're seeking to impose their views. I mean, there have been attempts at doing that.
What about this law in Texas, for example? The Texas abortion law.
When you come to the question of abortion, people say, well, you can't impose your religious views on the question of abortion. What I would say is, think about where our debate is. Our debate is over whether we're dealing with one person or two people. And in my viewpoint, we're dealing with two people. We're dealing with a vulnerable woman and a vulnerable child, and we need to protect both of them, and we need to love both of them. I can understand if people don't agree with me, but it's not imposing my view to do that any more than when I'm working in the area of immigration. And I would have some people who would say, well, come in and talk about how the Bible teaches loving the stranger and advocate for immigration reform. Okay. And then when I would talk about issues of abortion, would say, well, you can't impose your biblical beliefs on us. Well, you just wanted me to. And I think that both of those two things are legitimate, because when I'm saying to Christians, you ought to care for immigrants, that's not imposing my views on the government. It's saying to the government, this is something you should care about.
Russell, it's great to have you here. And so appreciate you engaging with our students here. I know you've had some robust conversations, and I think probably both you and they have learned from them. And thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I love the Acts Files and listen to it every episode.
Excellent. Well, you can listen to this one and tell me what I missed.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Acts Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Rafina Ahmad, Courtney Koop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.